Vale.
Hello there. Hello, do I have a connection? Nobody's there yet.
I'm here as well, John here, but I haven't heard anybody else yet.
Hi, I'm here. This is Catherine. I'm here.
Did you hear my question just a moment ago?
Well, someone hey, welcome. Thanks for your promptness. This is Dave. We're going to begin with the roadmap system today, the first three steps. I'm going to explain a little bit about what that is and how to think about it in addition to the materials you have. But first, I'm interested in any thoughts, questions, follow-ups you have or any reflections that you have on what we're talking about. What would be most helpful for us to discuss before we launch into the material? And thank you for each of you who have sent responses to those two questions. They're very informative and will help guide and shape some of my discussion, so I appreciate that very much.
Yeah, hi, Dave. This is Bonita. Can you hear me?
Hey, Bonita. I sure can. How you doing?
Actually, I'm still at work. I did my best to get out of here. I'm determined to participate, but I am at my clinic desk, and I'm hoping no patients
well,
will come in right now.
Well, there are a lot of healthcare providers, and I salute you.
Yeah, no worries. But I wanted to just point out to everyone, there is a lot of noise on the outside. So remind us of how to, not from me right now, because I'm in a quiet office.
Okay.
Can you remind us of the mute button that we should put?
Yeah, I thought we were doing really good with that. But obviously, if you're hearing something, if you would each mute *6 until you're ready to talk, and then unmute again *6 when you're ready to say something. And
excellent.
This is especially important if you're on like a cell phone or a computer phone, because that increases the technostatic. So, sorry, you're having difficulty. You're very clear. Anything else, Bonita? How are you doing, and how are you finding the material?
Well, I'm so far so good. I haven't had a chance to really do all the things that I was supposed to do with it because of a 16-hour commitment now because of what's going on.
Yeah, exactly.
But I did get in and answer the questions, you know, the annual income. I just haven't had a chance to send it in to you and to kind of broach some of those questions. I did spend some time doing that.
Okay, well, great. That's mostly between you and you, and
yeah.
Especially the exercises and work tools that can best prepare you to work with others. Plus, I don't want to be intimidated to see how much money you make. So, you
well, it isn't about all that, believe you me.
Keep that for yourself. Okay.
I got you, yeah.
Okay.
But I did love your response of that, but like you said, a passive voice. That stayed in my head all week.
Oh, okay.
in response to that statement. So I'll be looking to learn.
Listen to interviews, especially of it's most profound, I think, with athletes when they get to a point where they screwed up and they start saying, well, you know how you do when, you know.
Yes, thank you.
Yeah, okay. Well, thanks. Thanks for logging in. I appreciate it.
Okay.
And take good care of yourself.
I will, bless you.
First and foremost, yeah.
I'm here to learn.
Okay, well, super. Who else? Other thoughts, questions, things that would be helpful to talk about? Anyone? If not, I'll reserve a bit more time at the end for us to discuss if our discussion will sort of prime the pump for you to add or ask or comment.
Are you on mute?
I'm sorry, this is who? I heard someone speak, but I didn't quite hear who it was. Is. Well, let me just say, while we have an open mic, and I'll ask you again to be sure and manage the background, we're going to begin talking about the roadmap system that is simply a way, it's a performance macro system. It's a way to deconstruct and understand our own experience, our own stories and performance, and to systematically write new code for mind, brain, and behavior, including not only every story that we write, but our performance. So the roadmap system is an acronym for the 7 steps of what I see as a scientific and systematic way to deconstruct and understand our personally created stories and to strategically create a new story, a new behavior. Understanding behavior and performance algorithms couples with a methodology to create a new enhanced story. And you've heard me say many times, when you want to change something, behavior, a story, focus on the system, not just the goal. The development of corresponding new identity becomes the bedrock of this story, this transformation, to make it permanent. That's the P on the roadmap, and we're going to spend a good deal of time talking about that the last seminar, but this is kind of a preview of coming attractions, because as we've touched on before, one of the most powerful forces of the human psyche is to return to our identity. So unless we conceive of and systematically make the new story, the new model, the new way of doing things a part of our identity, or for our clients, we'll revert back to the old behavior. So this needs to be incorporated to transform identity along with transforming and changing a story. So this is exactly what we'll be talking about over the next 3 seminars. Are there any questions about that concept? Remember I mentioned, those of you who did not participate in the previous seminar series, a micro system of behavior is the neural conditioning chart. You can access that on the homepage of MentorPath, the Master States of Mind. It's a free webinar. It's 30 minutes, and you can download that that page. That's the micro system of understanding emotional triggers and rewiring the brain in terms of those emotional triggers. That's kind of a micro system. We're talking now about a macro system, the roadmap, a way of understanding our own algorithms of behavior, of beliefs and ideas that we construct a story, and how to change that. So this is about changing something as fundamental as our mind and brain. So final call for any questions or thoughts or additions before we move into the material. Okay, well, you won't have to worry about the background noise. I'm about to move into lecture mode, so hold on. We're going to talk in this seminar about translating money meanings. We've discussed your money story, the concept of writing a new story. We're going to look closely now at how to do that, at the principles and practice of change step by step. We're going to look at the essential steps of change to create a new money story that can be successful and fulfilling and based on revised or new belief systems. And remember, beliefs are the software that drive our behavior. So we can roadmap a new money story. We're going to apply these 7 steps to understand your money story in order to create a new one that can be more successful, more fulfilling, and evolve your identity. You see in the outline the 7 steps in summary. So let's begin to look at step 1, to recognize authorship of your money story. This seems pretty basic, that we assume that we believe, we know we're creating our own story. But remember this premise. Every moment we actively construct what we think, feel, and experience. Each is a choice. It doesn't always feel that way. Every day begins a fresh page. The dramas of everyday life don't simply affect us. They're created by us. This is how right now we're especially challenged to look at and focus on what we can determine and to come to accept and adapt to the background, especially all the unprecedented events that we can't determine. Yet, so often the story closest to us, our own, is the most difficult to really know. Insight, understanding, even coming to the end of the past to end an old story are important, but they're not enough. We have to create a new or at least revised story. So, how do you tell your money story to yourself to know what to keep, what to change, and then how to change it? Here are 4 principles in recognizing authorship. I mean, we think, well, of course we're creating our own lives, but that may be a bit elusive. Here are 4 principles to look at how much we create. Principle 1, our experiences are always consistent with our assumptions. Again, our beliefs write the software of our behavior. And we wouldn't need to be talking now if 100% of our operating system was conscious. We would simply make the adjustments, but 90 to 95% is not conscious. We see what we believe, and we're always right because we write the story. Now, a few of you have heard me tell this story again, but this is from Oxford a number of years ago. 2 anthropologists were chosen to enter separate, essentially identical ape colonies to live and observe for a year. The 2 anthropologists had remarkable similarities of personality, philosophy, education, and training. They lived for 2 years not communicating with each other at all, emerged to compare notes, and they expected essential similarities, but they found remarkable discrepancies. 1 anthropologist, after an initial period of transition, was accepted by the apes, integrated into the colony, and achieved a unity and comfort with the apes. The other anthropologist never got beyond the social periphery of the colony, remained careful and vigilant, always seemed right on the cusp of conflict, never reached a harmony or unity with the ape colony. The 2 anthropologists could not understand these really discrepant results or find any reasons. They and their teams puzzled for months until they finally found 1 difference. The anthropologist, who was the uncomfortable, careful outsider, always on the cusp of a problem, carried a gun. Now, his gun never showed. He never used it. The apes never knew he had it. But he knew he had it. He knew if things got tough, he had an out. The anthropologist who had no gun instead had a commitment. He knew from the beginning that he would either make it or not on his own. And in retrospect and reconstruction, each of their assumptions created the reality that they experienced. We tell our story, then our story tells us. A belief is the mind's command to the brain. With the same belief, you'll continue to have the same results. If you change your belief, you can have different results. Principle two, we don't see things as they are, we see things as we are. Our beliefs become our reality. Some things you have to believe in order to see. And our possibilities are always a manifestation of what we allow ourselves to consider. A story can define possibility. And you guys are familiar with this story. In centuries of recorded time, no one ran the mile in under 4 minutes. It was impossible. Dr. Roger Bannister broke the 4-minute mile in 1954. Within the following 18 months, over a dozen other runners also broke the 4-minute mile. The obstacle of the impossible could no longer be constructed. And today this is commonplace. A little sidebar story. He was a physician, Bannister, and the common wisdom at that time was if you run a mile in under 4 minutes, it will kill you. You'll actually end up dead. As soon as he crossed the finish line, Bannister collapsed. And then when he finally came to, he looked around and said, "Am I dead?" The beliefs within us, our own internal map of reality, determine our perception of what surrounds us, including what and how we select, register, and process. It's our radar. We code our own radar. Some of it's conscious, some of it's not. We construct our storylines from these premises. So, we have to bring our beliefs about money, finances, wealth, how much we can make, into conscious focus to assess how well they work in present time. Here's one example. One couple married a week before Black Friday, beginning the Great Depression. The poverty and scarcity of their situation centered on the reality and the metaphor of the Depression-era finances. Money was elusive for this family with 7 children, and they often struggled even to have enough food. They were proud that they had never gone on relief. That was the term at the time for welfare. This required the father to be away for several months at a time finding work in other states. Finally, after years of being exhausted and tired, the mother agreed to accept relief. Around this time, she had bartered canning vegetables for almost 3 years to have her home painted. Someone in the welfare agency passed by and saw her freshly painted house. This was a white guy looking at the freshly painted house of a black family. He called her and wondered, since she could afford to have her home painted, did they really need to be on relief? This proud woman responded, "Just take it back. I don't want it." For this family, money you didn't earn had strings attached. And I've never said this before, but that was my wife's grandmother. Their experience of the scarcity of money became a legacy amalgamating their life and money stories. 3 generations later, her granddaughter was going through a post-divorce move and adjustment with a difficult financial time supporting her 2 children, but was adamant about not asking for anything. She was determined not to become one of those people who took welfare. She carried the same torch of pride as her grandmother. She noted, "One of my children refused to eat the free lunch that she was offered at school because choices were limited. Her great-grandmother learned that you gave up certain freedoms with a free lunch." That great-granddaughter later graduated Princeton and went to California to become a screenwriter. The choices we make as parents are models that our children both emulate. They look, experience, and take unconscious notes. Those notes get passed on. We know that so many beliefs and behavioral patterns are downloaded during the first years of life without even conscious recognition. This is some of what we have to become aware of in that operating system that's 90 to 95% unconscious. Principle 3. A new story can occur only by living in the present moment. Social scientists discovered that when you measure people's present intentions, you can affect their future behavior. Think about how we do this as mentor coaches. When people are asked what they intend to do, they're more likely to act according to how they answer because they put it in an output channel of stating it. Plus, we want to be consistent with the image that we present others and ourselves of us. When you ask people the day before an election if they intend to vote, it increases the probability of they're going to vote by 25%. A study of 40,000 people asked, do you intend to buy a new car? The question increased purchase rates 35% when people said yes. Other behaviors with increased frequency, asking if people intend to eat certain foods, to diet, to exercise, to regularly fund retirement plans. The stated intention is most powerful when coupled with a specific action plan. Bonita, are you going to have broccoli with your dinner tonight? Remember, hope isn't a strategy. The lottery isn't a plan. Principle 4, our minds seek closure and infer causality whether or not it's accurate. This is something we have to be aware of, is a bias toward closure. A series of studies by Dan Gilbert of Harvard showed volunteers words appearing on a computer screen for a few milliseconds. This was such a short time that they were unaware that the words were shown and couldn't even pick them out from a multiple choice. This was subliminal programming, yet they were influenced by them. For example, when the word hostile was flashed, volunteers judged others more negatively. When the word elderly was flashed, volunteers would walk more slowly. When the word stupid was flashed, volunteers would perform slightly less well on tests. And when these volunteers were later asked why they judged or walked or scored the way they did, they denied that they did anything different. And they quickly then, when they were told and shown the films, for example, considered the facts that they were aware of and came up with some reason. For example, volunteers who walked more slowly said, well, I was a little tired when I did the test, or I've been traveling the last few days and I haven't slept well, or I was probably jet-lagged. Each was unaware of the fact that they were falsely attributing cause and effect. These findings demonstrate the desire we have to bring closure. Our brains to end any dissonance by imposing certainty, and for our minds to create a complete story by a causal explanation to bring closure and a sense of effectiveness, whether or not it's accurate. Complete trumps accurate. This is why we rationalize or justify or do any number of other mental gymnastics that bring closure at times without ownership or growth, a finish without an ending. And this is how confidence and clarity create an experience of trust in the listener. An application of this principle. A scam artist can create a cult-like following by offering an evocative promise that touches people's vague, hazy dreams to make them appear vividly in reach. I did a study of these kinds of con artists and scams for a much earlier book. The picture painted allows people to see what they want to see. People project their own desires onto a promising story that crystallizes a fantasy, maybe even of magical wealth. The scam artist is half of the co-creative story of the scam. The victim completes the other half. I decided at the time I'd learn as much about this as possible, and if things really got rough, I'd always have a scam to return to. I'll suggest you do the 4 exercises of step 1 to be sure you get the foundation of really recognizing your money story and the authorship of it. And remember the basic ideas of any story, plot and storylines. Plot are the core themes of money stories, in this instance, that inform what you look for and then how you attribute meaning to what you find. If you don't look for it, you're not going to find it. There's inattention blindness. You've coded your radar. Storylines. Your money story is your self-statement. Every time you make, use, or spend money, you're making your own self-statement. Step 2, own your money story. Review, I would suggest especially, the assumptions and motivations that construct storylines. The exercise on page 2.5 of the workbook. From an infinite sea of possibilities, our beliefs determine what we see and how we process. It's our software package. Adding more information to the millions of bits of data that we process daily, like a new diet or a health club membership, is not likely to have an impact unless you change the software. So, as we examine how a storyline is constructed, here's an equation that I think will be useful. This is in the outline. Beliefs drive behavior. Behavior drives performance. And some examples of empowering beliefs that you'll see in the workbook. I can make the money I need. I will find a way to love my work. Limiting beliefs. Now, these are not always conscious and logical. Limiting beliefs can influence reality and behavior. They can, in effect, be emotionally or physically based. I can't find the time to exercise. Hear each of these as a coachable moment, because this is an active story that someone is constructing, and if it's not working, that by definition is a coachable moment. Or if it's limiting, same thing. I can't find time to exercise. I don't have enough experience. I don't make enough to save anything. So these examples are from a variety of responses, behaviors, reactions, even complex patterns. Our imagination is limitless in its ability to create scenarios of disaster or of success. First, you have to recognize each experience as a choice instead of just the way things are. So here's the fundamental precept of step two, own your story. Whatever you experience, you either create or accept, which is just another way to say, whatever we think and feel and experience, we create each moment. So let's apply that notion by talking about two aspects, point of reference and active versus passive position. These are subtle ways to listen to your clients, to have both of you be more informed about how they're constructing their stories. And consider these two sets of ideas, especially as you do the exercises on can you make and enjoy money and money myths. So, point of reference. This is a basic component of story writing. People who don't own their stories have a premise of an external point of reference at times. And this can be a theme that includes passivity or resignation for certain things, feeling helpless. They transfer responsibility to someone or something outside themselves. They then react to situations they're in. So here are some examples, some characteristics of those with an external point of reference. And again, consider each of these as a coachable moment, which is exactly why with my clients, I have an agreement that I ask them permission to be able to interrupt them at any moment to look at something right when they say it, and for them to be able to interrupt me too to explain or understand something better. They feel as if they have little or no control over things. Just life is just to be reacted to. Well, there's nothing I can do. They're vulnerable to the responses of others. Their language can even absolve them of responsibility. She makes me so mad. They focus on responding rather than creating. Well, I have to do this. They see themselves as unchanging. Well, that's just the way I am. You can see how easy it is for me to say some of these things. They're practiced, by the way. They believe that they can only change things by changing the outside source or person. Or, if they experience a symptom in their bodies, they medicate it away. That's like seeing a warning light on the dash of your car and disconnecting it rather than pursuing the problem. Now, consider those with an internal point of reference. They see their authority as their own. Their premise is acceptance of responsibility, and they experience effectiveness. And they've known that at least since adulthood, they write their own stories. Here are their characteristics, and listen to these as things that we coach toward. They recognize accountability for their own lives. They're proactive. They plan. They look around the corner. If they experience an unpleasant result, they examine the chain of events that generated the result. Then they look for alternatives. always, or often, at the nudging of the mentor coach. When they see a result that doesn't work, they simply decide not to continue. They decide what to change and then initiate that change. They realize that the menu of choices is also created. You can choose, and you can choose how you choose. Now, let's listen to another perspective. And these are all subtle but very real components that can tell us a great deal that can help, I believe, in our mentor coaching. And these are all things that are designed to work by telephone. From the very beginning, I did 100% of my mentor coaching by telephone. So I think you can see, you can work as effectively, probably even more so, when you don't have the visual distraction. Although some of you may be doing things face-to-face 6 or more feet apart now. Another, recognize active versus passive positions. Listen to the passive language in some of these statements, as if the story is just happening to its author rather than being created. Well, I ran out of time, so I couldn't work out. I can't seem to put any money into savings. It just seems to keep happening. So, remember the anthropologist. The idea of a gun was enough to change everything. And I heard this recently from a prominent neuroscientist, Bruce Lipton. 95% of people have no genetic basis for their unhappiness, their fears, or what they're taking medication for. These passive positions disown a feeling, a thought, or an action as an active creation, as if the feeling that you create makes you its victim. My anxiety stopped me. My doubt paralyzed me. Remember, you created the anxiety that you then see as acting on you as if you were the victim. The story can take on an identity of its own. I'm a risk taker. I'm a bargain hunter. I'm a procrastinator. If someone sees a cumulative description of actions that they've initiated as if it were an identity, first of all, that's an eminently coachable moment, but it also makes it harder to change if they see it as an identity. And it can take on a life of its own. For example, someone creates credit card debt and then personifies it to become a victim of its demand and threat, a victim of its influence to decrease a credit score, and to take on a life of its own, as if the company that agreed to loan you money on your word to pay it back suddenly has a malevolent intent. So here's where I'd suggest review the exercise 17 Common Money Storylines. Examine the storylines as objectively as possible to see which ones resonate with your experience, or to use that to create your own versions of that. Not to judge or criticize yourself, but to inform. So, next step. Once recognizing and owning your money story, steps 1 and 2. Steps 3, assess your money story, plot, and storyline. A belief or a fact is an anatomical reality in the brain. And that's really important to remember. A physical part of a neuronal network. A teacher can't simply present a simple explanation and remove an existing neural network from the student's brain. You can't just list 3 reasons an idea is wrong and expect it's going to overwrite someone's neural network and neuronal pathways, or expect that presenting a new fact to your client will overwrite the one already there. Most likely, it will have the opposite effect, because it activates, if it's opposite what the client believes, activate the error detection mechanism. And I did a blog about this. The smarter that someone is, the more you try to use influence to persuade them, the more entrenched they will become, because the smarter they are, the more reasons they will think to counter your arguments. And it becomes a boomerang effect, just exactly the opposite of what you want. But change can occur. It's a process, not an event. It's an inside job. This step, to assess your money story, plot, and storylines, includes examining beliefs and assumptions to see if they're limiting and to try out other beliefs. The simplest way to begin, always surface before depth, is it working? Not the story you want to believe and inhabit, but is what you're doing working? If you have to pause, or if you say no, time to examine it. What's another way to look at this? How might my thoughts be limiting me? Who has a different perspective on this? Are there some questions I'm afraid to ask? And at some level, you already know what they are. Remember, denial is a powerful form of engagement. So's a secret. If you have time, read the essay on secrets and engaging the ineffable. It's my last book written for coaches, primarily. 21 essays on things that we deal with every day, but it's a lot more complicated than we think it is. What do I really want? And, importantly, what do I need to let go of? Every learning is a form of unlearning. We have to make room. We have to let go of something in order to take on something new, often. So here's a piece of the workbook, beginning 3.5, Distinguish and Address Ideals and Needs. This is really important to really understand for your client. This is often the only kind of tool I actually use with a new client to ask them to do a needs and ideals exercise to get an idea of what their fundamental, their core needs are and what their ideals are, what they strive for and aspire to, so that we both have a clear understanding of ideals and needs in synchrony with strategy and story so that all of them is going in the same direction. I think there's a case illustration in there where needs and ideals were in contradistinction to the stated goals that a mentor coaching client had. Needs are essential requirements, a necessity for mind, body, or spirit. And it's important to distinguish wants from needs. You can get sick if you don't have enough of a need. You can get sick if you have too much of a want. And you can never get enough of what you don't need. So let's look now at comfort zones. This is an important aspect of how we proceed and how our mind and brains work. We did the thumb exercise last seminar. A comfort zone is simply a familiar pattern of behavior. It's a gradual process, but once established, it resists change. Think of a comfort zone like your home thermostat. The temperature increases or decreases, often even a degree. It signals an adjustment to return to the set point, the comfort zone. Our minds and brains both contribute to this internally. We even have a comfort zone, for example, with our weight, with everything we do that becomes automatic. We return to the familiar even when we don't like it or when it's uncomfortable. A comfort zone is not necessarily comfortable. It's just familiar. It's predictable and automatic. We know the outcome. Think about how subtle a comfort zone can be in determining choices. What you eat, the difficulty of starting a new exercise program or a savings program. A comfort zone can be the repeated role you play in a relationship or procrastination of lifestyle changes you need to make. Or establishing a structured savings plan of paying yourself first. A comfort zone can manifest in certain patterns, storylines, or recurring characters. Working under pressure, waiting till the last minute, creating a crisis, all can paradoxically be a comfort zone. For example, someone can be an underdog and succeed against all odds. This can become a comfort zone of behavior in which the pattern is repeated. And when they succeed, they have to recreate being an underdog in order to succeed again. Here's another example of a comfort zone in action. Most lottery winners manage to spend or give away their newfound earnings to return to their previous situation. In the United States, just over 80% of lottery winners file bankruptcy within the first 5 years. This is for $3 million or more lottery winning. Their money changed, but their mindset didn't. So much money moved them from their comfort zone, and they ended up returning to it. I recall very vividly a buddy of mine sitting on the porch at my ranch. We were having a cigar and a single malt overlooking the lake, and somehow our conversation, he said, you know, I would never accept lottery winnings. I wouldn't know what to do. If I won a lottery, I would give away the ticket because it would disrupt my life so much, I just wouldn't know what to do with it. And I valiantly held counsel instead of saying, you know, I'm number one in line. I said, I think I understand. Here's another example. A simple Irish woman lived an ordinary life in a small village for over 4.5 decades. Then suddenly, Susan Boyle vaulted onto the world stage with Britain's Got Talent. One of the initial results is that she became overwhelmed and had to be hospitalized the day after the final completion. She, like the lottery winners, was not motivated to sabotage herself, but simply got on overload way beyond her comfort zone, out of the realm of anything she knew how to handle. In the beginning, departure from a comfort zone feels, by definition, uncomfortable. A rupture of continuity, a routine is broken. Sometimes letting go of a comfort zone occurs only when the pain is too great to remain in it. I see this again and again with people, performing artists, particularly in pro sports, sometimes in performing arts, who suddenly are incredibly wealthy, are incredibly famous, and they really haven't gone through the nickel's dime's worth of how to gradually incorporate it into an identity or develop the skills to handle the kind of pressure and the performance issues that go into it. So it's certainly something that that's exactly one of the things that we do very well as mentor coaches. The choices we make tend to be from our comfort zone. But a comfort zone trades passion for predictability, or can, creativity for continuity, and the new for the familiar. And remember, a habit is not a definition or an identity. It's simply a choice that gets repeated. So let's look at how to break out of a comfort zone. Your performance, even the money you make, operates in a similar way. When people get more successful, they feel vaguely to certainly uncomfortable, just different. If the results go outside their self-image, it cues that internal thermostat to return to the comfort zone. A comfort zone is an unconscious thermostat until it becomes conscious. Then you can reprogram your mind and brain. Your brain has a mind of its own. So, part of the assessment of your money story is to understand conflicted and contradictory storylines. When you feel with one part of the brain and plan with another, you need a map. A paradigm, also called a mindset, is simply a model. It's a theory or frame of reference, the way we see the world. What we perceive, understand, and interpret is our individual paradigm, our map. The paradigm is the map that explains the territory. It's not the territory itself. So with the right map, planning and strategy can make a huge difference. And we each have a number of maps or paradigms in our head, storylines. We're often not aware of having them, but just assume that we see things the way we do. For example, if you read the anxiety or the uncertainty of a new experience in an old paradigm, such as anxiety equals danger ahead, better head for cover, uncertainty means wrong decision, it makes sense to stop. A current paradigm may reframe the excitement or trepidation of moving ahead in new territory as a signpost of progress, and think about how we need to do that regularly with our clients. Another way of saying this, our brains don't know the difference between anxiety and excitement. It's how we frame it, how we interpret it, that determines which direction we head and what we do with it. So it's important to frame it correctly. Another example, we need to be afraid of the right thing. We fear often what's easily remembered, the recency effect. We fear what we can't control, the desire to be effective. It's a lot more dangerous to be behind the wheel of a car, but in airplane seat 18C, we feel no control. It's an availability bias, a prediction based on greater emotional charge. Or smokers who are afraid of flying. Average across all participants, smoking shortens their lives by 5 years. Average across all participants, flying shortens their lives by 1 day. People fear someone entering their homes and committing a violent crime more than food daily entering their bodies that clog arteries and cause heart attacks. And are you afraid enough of not having abundance in later years to plan and save now? There are a lot of studies that show money is not related to happiness and a bunch of other things it promises or represents, but here's one relationship. As you think about saving for the future, this one relationship, this one thing many that money influences for all classes and all groups of people. Choice. One of the unique qualities we have as human beings is self-awareness, the ability to reflect on how we think and what we do. This means we can learn from our experiences and from others as well. This is why we can create a new story. We are not our old story. We created our old story, but we're going to have to tweak our identity to make that transformation. We are not our habits or our thoughts. We create them. We can think about things, reflect on them, examine our paradigms to see if they serve us well. So we have to assess our money stories, to monitor our choices, to question our ideas, to probe our reasoning, and fundamentally, to ask clearly and honestly, does it work? Not bargaining with yourself or not looking at the story you want to inhabit or saying it's going to give out. Does it work? Here's a quote for the guys, because we're inevitably the ones who will not stop and ask directions, even when we're hopelessly lost. This is from C.S. Lewis. He said, we all want progress, but progress means getting nearer to the place where you want to be. And if you've taken a wrong turn, then to go forward does not get you any nearer. I question his manhood, of course. If you're on the wrong road, progress means doing an about turn and walking back to the right road. And in that case, the man who turns back soonest is the most progressive man. Notice that Lewis even said man consistently. You're always reaching your goals, whether they're conscious or unconscious, so it's necessary to assess exactly what they are. If your personal or your professional life is not as gratifying as you would like, if you believe you've not attained your objectives, look more closely. It's helpful to know consciously and specifically what those goals are because we're always reaching them. You might be undermining your success by being too vague in your objectives. Do you fear specifically yet dream vaguely? For example, if you want to change your body, begin with changing your body image and then create a system to get there. Visualize the specific image you want to achieve, your ideal body image, your true body self, not a false body self of overweight or out of shape, or of 20 years ago, or of someone else. Then create an informed plan to get there, a system. Your body is the projection of your mind's software. So is your savings account. Listen to your language in regard to your goals. If you say you'll try to reach a goal, you may be protecting yourself from anticipated failure. Trying immediately says there's not a full commitment. It's an out, a potential diversion to other alternatives. You know the words of somebody not committed. I'll try, I should, I ought to, I know I need to. These build in a takeaway, a detraction, by not being totally committed. When somebody says, I'm going to try to quit drinking, you know they're going to keep drinking. Here are the words of somebody committed. I will. So, let's bring this together now and talk about creating a new belief. How we tell our stories of the past will shape our future. Some stories will get told so much or so often that they achieve the status of becoming a personal myth. If I were just loved enough, if I just had enough money. When you're ready to write a new belief, focus on it frequently and return to it regularly. The new belief has to replace the old belief. Create a vision of yourself getting the results from the new belief. A brief story to illustrate how the value we attribute, the belief, can fundamentally change how we perceive something from the beginning. Nathan Handworker, now you know this better be a good story with a name like that. Nathan Handworker put in a new food stand in 1916 in Coney Island. Handworker's hot dogs were pure beef made from his wife's recipe, every bit as delicious as his competitors, but he priced his at 5 cents. The other hot dogs were 10 cents. He attracted no customers. People wondered, of course, if his hot dogs were inferior and attributed poor quality ingredient to his products. His sales were not increased when he offered free root beer and free pickles. The free products simply enhanced the belief that his product was inferior and the perception that it was inferior. Then, Handworker came up with a new ploy. He asked doctors from a nearby hospital to stand around eating his hot dogs while they were wearing their white coats and stethoscopes, and he raised his prices. His hot dogs started selling. People assumed that a physician were eating his food, and it cost at least as much and more than most of his competitors, it had to be good. So Nathan's famous hot dogs began selling well and became a national phenomenon. So, Catherine, Regine, Jolanda, what did you decide you're going to charge for your coaching fees as a monthly retainer? Creating a new belief is not an instantaneous thing. It's a process. It can take some period of time. It can occur quickly. It can take years. The process of changing a belief is just that, a process, not an event. It can be planned, though, systematically, step by step, with incremental progress. So, don't compare your inside to somebody else's outside. That's not an apples-to-apples comparison. Your journey, your timetable, your progress is not in reference to somebody else. It's in reference to you, your story. It's uniquely yours. However long it takes, you can make it worth it, and you can assess if there's anything you're doing that's delaying or can speed up the process or make it a better performance. And you can always know the difference between dosing and timing from avoidance. That's huge, I think. In changing your belief and the result of the change in your action, you're also changing your mind as well as your brain. The choices generate the moment-by-moment life we each create. The programming of our internal map of reality, our software, determines what it will be. At any moment, neural networks are influenced by three factors: genes, experiences, and focused attention. Regardless of someone's unique brain architecture and individual complexity, these three factors intersect at any moment, at any nanosecond. DNA downloads its information from expression of its code. We now know it also goes in the other direction. This is epigenetics. Our experiences, our beliefs, can turn genes on and off to determine the major extent of the expression of DNA-based information. That's how powerful a new story can be. So, a final thought. What remains unconscious is most likely to be attributed to fate. Okay, we're in discussion mode now. If you'll manage the background noise and come off of mute only when you want to comment or question, I'd like to hear from you, your thoughts, questions, things that would be helpful for us to talk about. If you identify yourself first and then jump in. What do you think about this? Yes, go ahead.
I'm going to jump in. I was waiting. I wanted to be courteous. This was excellent. I got to tell you, the one thing I appreciated this time around is I think it's readiness to hear.
Ah, okay.
Readiness. I think it's readiness. And I recognize
16 hours of consistent work to move your defenses down hasn't hurt, but I hear you, and I think that's important, too.
Exactly, because I can see how the comfort zone, thank goodness for a decision not to judge myself.
Yeah, huge.
I'm not going to judge myself. I just want to move forward. And in doing that, I'm going to be able to help my clients to move forward instead of watching the success that they gain from the guiding them and then comparing that to your own life and coming home and saying, what is it about my choice to allow where I'm at in the same scenario to go on? Now, you're triggering me in so many ways, my friend, to become very proactive and write a new script to recognize where I'm at.
Well, I think that's so important. The point that you make is about how we can best help our clients by understanding and writing the best stories possible for us. In fact, the guy who started this whole business, professional coaching, Thomas Leonard, said, you know, after all, we just have to be one step ahead of our clients. And, of course, sometimes a half a step has to be, we have to be satisfied with. But thank you, and I think that's so important and why I'm emphasizing that everyone do the exercises and work tools themselves to really get an appreciation, because this is your experience. This is your tool that you're developing. The way that we develop self-reflection, self-awareness, and self-regulation, all the things that self come in front of are the tools that we use to best help our clients do this as well. So, great point. Thank you very much for mentioning that.
Dave, this is Wayne. Did you say at one point that beliefs can change genes?
Yes. That's the whole new area in the last few years of epigenetics, that beliefs can change gene expression. Not the gene itself, the DNA, RNA, but gene expression. You know, a simple example is how what we eat can determine some of that expression. When we eat broccoli, it has a certain chemical that goes through steps to enhance dopamine through an amino acid expression. So everything that we do is important. We're just now coming to see how vital it is that everything that we do is important and why and how it happens.
Thank you.
Absolutely. In fact, the guy I mentioned, Bruce Lipton, is a pioneer in this area of epigenetics, and there are a number of other people who have done a great deal of work in this whole mission to help us understand more about what actually is involved as we go through changing mind and brain. You know, one thing that I've been immersed in for the last really 18 months is looking at the mind and brain science applied to performance and how crucial it is to really do that in a way that can develop the entire performance zone to make that a default mode, to hardwire it to enhance performance without having to think about it. All the aspects that go into that for optimum performance, whether that's in the arts, in the professions, in pro sports. There's more and more that we know about this just in the last very few years. It's fascinating stuff. Other thoughts, questions, comments?
Actually, Dave, this is Aiden here. This is awesome,
yeah,
I have so many questions, but I'm going to try to not go crazy. The main one is,
pick your best
is there a way
start
to
start with?
Exactly. I'm going to try to stick to one.
Oh, okay.
Is it a professional coach then? I'm working on it.
Okay.
Is there a way to get a recording of, or is there a way to hear this session back to hear some of this stuff a
second
time?
Yeah, all of these, all the four teleconferences are recorded and posted usually within the next 24 hours, often shorter, at that link, where the link you went to download the outline and the workbook, there are four ports there that have recordings.
Gotcha.
So, and you can do a fast forward and do all kind of gyrations to listen to it again if there are components that you want to listen to again.
Okay, and actually, then I'll jump on one more. This is, you know, it's been brewing for me in the past two sessions as you've talked, because of your past, especially in, you know, psychoanalysis, right, in terms of practicing?
Uh-huh.
I'm a
psychoanalyst in recovery, but go ahead.
Okay, fair. I'm a Jungian. I mean, I'm training as a coach, but eventually I want to be a Jungian analyst. And something I keep hearing is the emphasis on, you know, a focused attention and belief and these things that we can do from a conscious standpoint. And I'm wondering, you know, because the weight of the unconscious can be so much in a person's decision-making and affect and these types of things, is that stuff you found is really accessible a lot of the time in coaching as opposed to a depth psychology approach? I'm trying to learn where that line is drawn.
Yeah,
and
even better, more accessible, and more useful. In fact, when I mentioned the microsystem of the neural conditioning chart, that's a microsystem of change. When I'm talking about the roadmap system, that's understanding the algorithms that go into our behaviors, our beliefs, our experiences, 90 to 95% of which is unconscious. But we can understand how to look at that, how to decipher that, how to look at the elements, and how to deconstruct our stories to create new ones. We can do this better and faster in coaching than psychoanalysts and therapists, because we don't go back into problems. Every time you go, can I get a mute on the background noise? You know, I love kids, but not this moment. Okay. Every time that we go into a problem to understand it better, ostensibly to resolve it, it etches it further in our brain. In contradistinction, whenever we look at possibility, it creates new pathways, new ways of looking at things, activates networks in our brain. So that's why coaching can be so much better. And that's why people get stuck in therapy, because they figure out all the answers. There's still the pathway. I'm simply cute, please. R6 as a mute, out of curse, all of them, please. I'm back on lecture mode, but I'd rather not, because I'll hear a question. Let me have a question or a comment, and I'll go on lecture. Stepped away, obviously.
Can you hear me, Dave?
Yes, I can.
My name is John. I'm from New Zealand.
Welcome.
And thank you. Yeah, I'm on my phone, so it's costing me an arm and a leg. I can't figure it out on the computer. But I was interested in the comment you made on the singer that won the American Idol or English Idol. When she was overwhelmed with her success, would it have been good for her to have coaching about her success, etc., before, or can she still get it after, or did she actually get coaching, do you think, after?
I don't know her answer. I don't know her story. I know the very similar thing happens with professional performers. I work with pro athletes and actors, and the very same thing that you experience with the greater suddenness. I mean, an athlete goes from 0 to 60 million in less than a day. So, yeah, they're going to have the same kind of totally different experiences and looking at how to create a system to regulate, to make decisions, all of that. It's exactly what we do in coaching. For someone to write a better story, to change and transform into a new story, the same kind of thing happens when people leave the military, when they retire, when they change jobs. I mean, we deal with that kind of thing all the time. Think about how each of you dealt with what you did when you changed into the profession of professional coaching from whatever you were doing before. That was a huge deal. For me, it was a huge deal. I bet for every one of you it was. We have the experiences and we have the tools to look at things in a systematic way to help people change and transform. I know we're out of time. We're a few minutes over, and I apologize. If there's anything else that any of you have, jot it down, and we'll pick up right here next time and have some discussion at the beginning of the next seminar. Thank you so much for your energy and questions and joining in. I appreciate it, and I look forward to picking up with you right here next time. Have a great rest of the week. Take good care of yourselves.
See
you. Thank
you,
Dave.
Thank
you,
Dave.
You too.
Thank you.
Dave's healthy.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Awesome.
Thanks, Dave. Okay. Bye-bye.
That was great. The line's now closed for everybody. Are people still there? I think it's closed. Okay.